I'm going to be doing something today I don't think I have ever done in my preaching career. And that is set aside the sermon I had been working on all week to do something a little bit different. Now, I'm not going to completely abandon this morning's text that was read by Biff, nor even the theme that is encapsulated in the title, 11 o'clock, 11:11. Indeed, I will even offer an explanation for why the bulletin refers to Armistice Day and not Veterans Day. But this morning, when I suspect many of you were still asleep, I was up doing what I normally do on a Sunday morning, and that was reviewing what I was going to preach. And I do this regardless of whether I'm going to preach from a manuscript or if I am going to deliver the message extemporaneously. I fiddle, I tweak, I edit, I revise. And indeed, I keep doing that right until I come up into this pulpit. But long before Sunday morning, I've got the sermon done. I know what's happening. It's mapped out. It's in my head. It's ready to go. I was going to preach off a manuscript today. And I was reviewing what I had written when Chip wandered into the study at the parsonage. And he climbed into the reading chair I have there. And he looked at the books I have on my shelves, books he has seen many times before, books with which he is quite familiar. And he looked at me and said, "Papa, why do you have so many books on war? Talk about a question for Veterans Day. Talk about a question for Armistice Day." Now, I responded to Chip by saying that I loved history, and war has been a big part of history. And it's something that interests me. And we talked about it a little bit more, and we talked about the Civil War. He has a deep and abiding interest in Lincoln, and he talked about how Lincoln fought the war to free the slaves. And then, as is the wont of six-year-olds, something else captured his imagination, and he moved on. But he left me with that question. "Papa, why are there so many books on war here?" And I thought about it. I've grown up with it. I think about my late father. He was an officer in the Army in World War II. All of my uncles also fought in that conflict. I thought of some cousins I have who fought in the Gulf War, the first one. And of my nephew who will graduate from Norwich University this coming spring and will go on active duty. All good Army men. And I suspect that it would have bothered them to no end that when I was in college, I came very close to taking a commission in the United States Navy. I didn't do that. I did, however, almost pursue a PhD in national security studies. But events took me along a different path, one that has led me to your pulpit. But the interest in war has not gone away. What draws people to fight, how nations resolve their differences, the politics involved, the economics, still fascinate me. And it is part of our larger world. As I think about the years in which I've grown up, I'm 48 now. As a child, we had Vietnam. Then, in college, we had Grenada. When I was in graduate school, we had the first Gulf War. Then as an adult, Afghanistan, Iraq, not to mention all of the other actions that have taken place. And of course, it's not just the United States that's been at war. We have other countries around the globe that have been involved in conflicts, hot and cold. But I found myself holding this question, why so many books on war? And I thought about today's lesson from Isaiah. Think about it. Concluding phrase in verse 4. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. And I thought, what would it be like to live in a world in which all of those history books I have on America and Europe and Asia and strategy and policy, if those books made no sense to anyone? Does it seem impossible to imagine, to envision? I will confess, I am not a pacifist. Perhaps I'm too cynical and too jaded. Perhaps the notion that we are a fallen people resonates too strongly with me. I'm not going to offer facile questions like, who would Jesus bomb? But I am still troubled, and deeply so. And my hope is that you too are troubled as we consider these matters and think about these things. The verse we read from Isaiah might seem like a Pollyannish hope. Pie in the sky thinking. Yet another one of these religious people who is completely divorced from reality. And yet we should recall that Isaiah was a figure at court. Imagine the equivalent of a counselor to the president. He knew what was going on. And he lived in an era and in a place where war and power politics were the way of the day. Judah was a small monarchy, neighbored by other small monarchies, with their armies and their kings who liked to go to war with one another, and they would feel pretty good about themselves when they scored a victory. And this has been going on for quite a while. And then something happened that completely changed everything. One of those moments in history that was actually a first. And that was the rise of Assyria to the east. The first great transnational conquering empire. In the past, great powers would usually go forth. They'd invade a country, they'd take what they want, and they'd leave. Not the Assyrians. They came, they stayed, they kept what they wanted, and they often deported the local people. And this menace from the east, which had been out there, very quickly found itself on Judah's doorstep, picking off her neighbors one by one, Syria and Edom and Israel. And so a logical reaction might have been to batten down the hatches, fight to the last man, give up in despair. And yet we have this prophecy that is shared by Isaiah, a prophecy which you will also find in Micah chapter 4, which suggests that this vision, this hope, was abroad in the community. This vision of a world at peace. And it wasn't just the vision of the underdog who didn't want to be beaten up, because if we read Isaiah carefully, these words, and indeed the entire book, we see that Isaiah sets aside the distinctions between us and them. Those foreigners, those people who worship a different God, have to get their acts straight and do things our way. That's not what he's saying here. He's saying that the people of Judah, the Jews, will also come to God. That message comes to us. If we are heirs to this promise, then this is true, that Christians should be coming back to God also. Not worrying for people to become Christians to get it right, but figuring out how all of us, as God's children, can find a way to move together into the things that unite us. Veterans Day was first celebrated formally in 1954, after Congress passed legislation with the support of President Eisenhower, creating a holiday that would recognize all those who had served in all of the nation's wars. It was an opportunity to recognize the living and the dead who had fought for America. But there are people here who will remember that before that day, we celebrated Armistice Day, a date that was set aside to remember the fallen dead of the First World War. There's something very powerful in that. Because on Armistice Day, we were recognizing a day and a moment with other countries that were also holding similar commemorations for a similar event. Recognizing those who had fallen, those who were lost. It was an opportunity to recognize and to honor those who had perished in what were often senseless conditions. All of this was running through my head in recent days, but particularly this morning, after Chip left the study. And I was sitting at my desk and I was looking at a wall of books before me. And my gaze settled upon Edmund Morris's trilogy about Theodore Roosevelt. The third volume of this biography was published last year. It's called Colonel Roosevelt, and I recommend the entire trilogy to you. But this book follows Roosevelt in the years after he was president. Now, T.R. was probably the most colorful and outsized personality who has ever inhabited the White House, and I suspect ever will. He's a scholar, an author, an explorer, a scientist, politician, and a warrior. It was in a war that he made his name nationally, gaining fame in Cuba and San Juan Hill, making his way to governor's office in New York and the vice presidency and the presidency of the United States. That experience was always with Roosevelt, and it was something he found exhilarating and enlivening. Even in the years after he left the White House, he still thought back to those days. And so as war with Germany loomed, Roosevelt went to Woodrow Wilson and offered to raise and lead a brigade. He wanted to be with troops in battle. And he told friends of his that he could imagine no more glorious way to die than to fall on the field of battle. Wilson declined Roosevelt's offer. And T.R. was frustrated and disappointed and angry. But he drew a measure of comfort from knowing that his four sons, Ted and Archie and Kermit and Quentin, would all be fighting for the United States or Britain. They all put on the uniform. They all served honorably. And Roosevelt took great pride in this. But all of the visions of glory, all of the dreams, died in the skies over France in the spring of 1918 when Quentin Roosevelt's aircraft was shot down in a dogfight. The fate that Theodore Roosevelt had sought for himself, that he had so wished for, to die in battle, instead fell to his son. Theodore Roosevelt did not die on a battlefield, but he did die of a broken heart. And this will sound trite and cliched, but as I thought about that this morning, I thought, good God, I hope I am never in Theodore Roosevelt's shoes, that I never have to mourn the death of my son in battle. I think of all of the parents who have had to do that. And then I think of this prophecy in Isaiah. Words many of us know. Perhaps you've visited the UN in New York. You've seen them chiseled out front. But I think our call as Christians, as the faithful, is to discern how we can take these words on a wall and turn them into a living reality. I do not say it is easy. And honestly, I don't know that I have the answers. But I think they are worth pursuing. And I think in this fallen world, where we so often think that there is no way forward, we can think of the voice of Isaiah and Micah and all of those who have lifted up their words over the millennia. We can think of our God who came to us in the person of Jesus to show us a different way. And we can know that we are not alone, that there is a way forward. And so my hope and my prayer is this day, and on each November 11th, on or about 11 o'clock, you'll remember the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month was the moment that the armistice went into effect. We'll set aside a minute to reflect on those who have fallen, on the opportunities and hopes that were lost, and then commit ourselves to ensuring that similar hopes and opportunities are not lost for today's generation and generations yet to come.